All right, great. So I don't know if I've told you guys about, I had a mentee, someone I was mentoring in the mindfulness teacher training program from Ukraine, which spending time with him has been intense. And I encouraged him a few months ago to write about his experience. So he did. And I kind of helped him put it together a little bit. And I really want it to be published by a Buddhist magazine for people to, hear from a voice of Dharma. He's a mindfulness teacher. He's not explicitly a Buddhist, but it's the Dharma. And to hear that from someone who's in this place. And he had a mindfulness center in his home city, Nikolaev, which has been basically destroyed and taken over. So they've moved away, had to move away. And so he put this together, and I decided, I know some publisher, some magazines that I've been in, but I know other people who were like, they'll listen to immediately. So I sent it to Tara Brock, and Tara sent it to Tricycle today. So we will see if they take it, because it was really like very emotional for me. I just, Mikhail is with his wife, who is also a mindfulness teacher, and his daughter, who's a teenager, and it's just so hard. He's very kind of stoic, he's not like a complaining, like I would be, like I'd be like, he's very steady and balanced, but I know underneath it's just so agonizing. So hopefully that'll get published and people will hear about it, because my long-term goal is that we help him rebuild his center when the war is over, and that we can get Buddhists in America to support Mikhail and his center, which is called Life in Flow. So I wanted to share that, and I wanted to put it on the recording too, just so people would hear it and plant a seed maybe for something in the future. So thank you all for showing up on this Friday night, February 17th, 2023. At least that's the time that we keep in this era. I don't know if someone in the distant future will find these recordings and wonder what 2023 refers to, because they might have like a different calendar by then. So, it's supposedly it's 2023 years after this religious leader was born. And that's sort of what it's based on for those who in the future who are not familiar with this. So so we start with meditation, and I'm sure in the future they'll be much better at meditating, so they might want to skip through this part. But for those of us who are still here trying to figure it all out, we will sit for about 20 minutes. I've been working a little bit with doing a little body sweeping meditation. So just for a little change of pace, I'm going to take you through that. If you don't want to do that, just ignore me and do your own practice, Starting by settling into your posture, coming into stillness. Upright, or you can be lying down if that's easier for you. And just starting to feel yourself in a body. The Buddha suggests that we actually start by knowing that there is a body. So just feeling your body sitting. And then let's start by just feeling the sensations in your face. And I like to do this quickly to begin. So moving from your face down through your neck to your shoulders. Moving the attention down the left arm. The upper arm, the elbow, lower arm, the hand, left hand. And then the right arm, upper arm, elbow, forearm, right hand. Just touching on these places. Just feeling through the body. Feeling the torso, the chest, belly, back, feeling the breath moving in this part of the body, and down through the pelvis, the buttocks, the left leg, thigh, knee, calf, ankle, left foot. The right leg, thigh, knee, calf, ankle, right foot. And then one more time, going back to the face. A little slower this time, feeling the eyes, the nose, the lips, the tongue and the inside of the mouth, cheeks and jaw. And you can scan back across the head, the top of the head, the ears, temples, back of the head. And the neck, front and back. And the left shoulder, downward to the bicep, upper arm, the elbow, the left forearm, the left wrist, the left hand, and take a moment to feel each finger on the left hand individually. Just placing your attention briefly on each finger. Seeing that your attention can be directed in this specific way. And the right shoulder, the right bicep, upper arm, elbow, forearm, wrist, and the right hand. Feeling each finger of the right hand. And into the torso, the chest and belly, feeling the breath. In the back, upper back, lower back. The pelvis, the buttocks, the left leg, thigh, knee, calf and shin, ankle and foot. The right leg, thigh, knee, calf and shin, ankle, and the right foot. Now just of pulling back and trying to feel the whole body at once, all the different sensations at once, feeling the singleness of the body and the diversity of the body all at once. And then letting the attention come to rest on the breath, either at the nostrils or the belly. Feeling the in-breath, feeling the out-breath. As the mind wanders, just gently bringing it back, letting go of thinking, reconnecting with the breath and the body each time. Trying to find a balance in your effort so that there's not grasping or rejecting of the thoughts. But there is still energy and engagement, not just drifting. See if you can find the pleasure within the breath, the pleasure of being in the present moment. All right. Welcome again from near and far. I'm Kevin Griffin, and we have been going through my book, A Burning Desire, Dharma God and the Path of Recovery, now for some months, at least. And we've gotten to the beginning of step 7. This book doesn't cover all the steps. It just covers the steps that have a reference to God in them. Some of my other books do cover all the steps, like One Breath at a Time, or the Buddhism 12 Steps Workbook, for instance. But this one was focused on the God question or problem issue. And this is always... Step 7 says we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And of course, I don't accept that God is male. But beyond that, asking anything to remove our shortcomings is quite an ask. Would you please take away my problems? Thank you. Oh, good. We tried that with drugs. It didn't work. Alcohol that didn't work, food didn't work, sex, gambling, spending, shopping, other people never removed our shortcomings. And even the language of shortcomings is, you know, one that some people have resistance to. You know, the earlier steps as defects of character, which is even perhaps more problematic. So, you know, I think it's worth just talking about a little bit how the steps talk about our problems, you know, besides the addiction problem. You know, that step 4 says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory. So it's sort of looking at things from a moral standpoint. The 5th step says we admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. So there's morals and wrongs. Then step 6 says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and that which is the phrase that I think is least favored, considering ourselves to be defective in some way, and that it's character defect, which sort of sounds really problematic in terms of getting rid of that, because if it's part of your character, isn't it sort of permanent? And of course, from a Buddhist viewpoint, that doesn't make sense that it's permanent. And then we have the shortcomings here in step 7. And to me, I'll just say, like, my take on all this is don't get in an argument with the language of the steps, because that's just a dead end. You know, let's try to understand what the steps are trying to talk about and see, you know, take them as a process. And what is the process? And so you know, I think it's interesting that the steps give all these different kind of characterizations of our issues or our problems, or, you know, and these are things that we could think of as psychological. Some of them may be behavioral, some of them addictive, related to addiction, like obsessiveness or, clinging. And so, you know, in Buddhism, we have the 5 hindrances, which are, you know, desire, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, doubt. And although they are kind of primarily talked about in relation to meditation, they also relate to our broader lives and what can be useful about using them as a model for, you know, shortcomings or defects of character, is that they're viewed not so much as personal, but as sort of more energies or just qualities that we experience. We experience moments of desire, moments of aversion. It's just like we have moments of sleepiness or restlessness and doubt. And so I think that's one thing that's really helpful in this kind of process, is to kind of step out of the, it's me, or I have this problem, or I have this shortcoming, that's like some kind of ownership or identification with, and just deal with the stuff as patterns. Yeah, I mean, I think of them as patterns, difficult patterns, unhelpful patterns, destructive patterns, so that they aren't just random in our lives. Like when we do an inventory or when we do any kind of self-examination, we recognize that each of us does have our own sort of version of these issues. So it's not like, oh, it's just totally not me, but you know, how we hold that sort of these patterns, these, and again, I don't love character, but how it kind of holds, you know, this, like these things that are persistent in my life, you know, these different moods and different personality traits. And so, you know, there's this balance to me between the disidentifying, not taking them personally, and the taking responsibility for them so that I can work with them. And hopefully, if I can't transform them, which maybe that can happen, but if I can't necessarily get rid of them, how do I hold them? How do I manage them? So that question then becomes one, both an internal question of how I live with feelings and things that I experience internally, and also an external question about how I act on these things, how I speak on these things, how these things manifest in my life. And again, then there's this this work we have to do, right? Which is like, first of all, I have to learn to live with my feelings. If I'm going to stay sober, if I'm going to be happy, you know, and sometimes those feelings are going to be difficult or painful or confusing. Sometimes they'll be uplifting, you know. But, you know, I have to have this relationship with them. And, you know, I was thinking today how I think one of my strongest sort of dharmic qualities is towards compassion, and towards compassion for myself and compassion for other people, which, you know, that's nice. It's good I have that. But I also see that part of that is because I tend to focus on the negative, you know? And so it's like, okay, yeah, that's sort of who I am. Like, I shouldn't put it in that way if I'm trying to be a Dharma teacher here. You know, that's a pattern that arises, you know, persistently. And I can, you know, some people really don't like that in me. Like, and, you know, give me a hard time. Oh, you're so negative. Okay. But it's really hard for me to like not look at things through this sort of doubtful mind, like look for problems, you know. And there's a certain value in that, because if you don't notice problems, then you got problems that you don't realize you have. And so the critical mind, you know, can be a constructive thing that's looking to ultimately find solutions to problems. So that's where I try to go with that. So, the In any case, you know, I also, I guess, once again, I'm sort of using myself as the guinea pig, hopefully example, not like, aren't I interesting, or let's talk about Kevin, but rather, you know, hopefully you're thinking of your own ways of being as I'm describing my own process here. And that, you know, by knowing the patterns that tend to arise for me, for each of us, that we know our patterns, we can then intervene at times when we see that this isn't a helpful time to express that pattern, right? Like if you're somebody who tends to be negative or somebody who tends to be positive, and you know, and your friend is really sick or something, and it's like, oh, you'll be fine. And it's like, well, maybe that's not the best thing to say for them when they're, you know, if they're really in the midst of something really difficult. Yes, you want to encourage them, but being, you know, Pollyanna might not be the most helpful thing. So just to sort of bring mindfulness to these habits so that they are not destructive, so that you're, you know, you contain them kind of in a constructive way. So that was not a plan, as you can probably tell. It was just sort of spontaneous to thinking about this, because I think it's really important with the steps to like ask ourselves what they are asking, what they're really about. And this has been an ongoing question for me. When I first worked step 6 and 7 back in 1986 with my sponsor, I just did them like they were written. You know, I had written my inventory over the course of months. One Sunday morning, I went to his house after our home group, shared it with him, went home, and the big book says, you know, then review that you've really done all the previous steps, and then, you know, ask God to remove your shortcomings, all that. And, you know, and I did that process. But very quickly, I had this question, like, how is this supposed to work? How are my shortcomings or defects of character or whatever you call them, these patterns, how are they supposed to change? And what am I supposed to do to, you know, who believes, does anybody believe? I don't believe that God removes shortcomings. You know, as I like to describe, it's like psychic surgery. God reaches into you and pulls out your shortcomings. Silly, you know. So, and when I look around, certainly my experience in the 12-step world, I never saw somebody just sitting in the corner praying, God, please remove my shortcomings, please, just waiting for them to be removed. People were out there changing their lives, doing things, or active, you know, maybe in therapy and writing inventories, and, you know, and besides, you know, behaving well in the world and trying to be good people. And so it also always seemed like it was the language of the steps was not really describing what people did. And so when I came upon this quote from Ajahn Buddhadasa, I felt like it answered the question that I'd been asking for a long time. I have that right in the beginning of chapter 7 in A Burning Desire. So chapter 7, I call it Letting Go. And then the first section is called Asking God to Help Us Grow. So if you are reading along, I am on page 183. It says, step 7 is where we again run into the stumbling block of how God is supposed to change us. Again, we're faced with the idea of a magical process of being fixed by some external entity or force. Ajahn Buddhadasa addresses this question when he analyzes the biblical saying, ask and it will be given you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened to you. He says about this passage, from the Buddhist point of view, this too is a matter of karma. We must act, That is, we must ask, seek, and knock for God to be moved. Mere faith is not enough. Even if one sits down to pray, it still will not be enough. In this context, the word ask implies an earnest effort to bring about a desired result. That is to say, we beseech the law of karma through our action and not merely with words. We beseech the law of karma through our actions, not merely with words. And that's a phrase that I have memorized and use whenever I teach step seven. Come back to it over and over. And even without going beyond this part of this chapter, just to go back and first say, when he says, from a Buddhist point of view, this is a matter of karma, we must act, he's referring to the fact that karma means action. So this is, you know, I know many of you know this. I'm just kind of reviewing just to make sure people are clear that in our culture, we adopted this word karma as having some magical meaning, that it's about fate. And in the Sanskrit or in the Pali language, it does not refer to fate. It refers to actions. And then where we get the fate idea is that the law of karma says that actions have results. So those actions, or those results, pardon me, are what people are usually talking about when they say, oh, it's my karma. You know, but what we really mean is that through some thoughts, words, or deeds, this result is manifesting. So that points to another critical idea of karma, that karma is not just external actions. It includes thoughts, it includes speech, and it includes then, you know, behaviors and actions. So this is a critical idea, because the idea that you are creating karma, in other words, there are results from your thoughts, puts a great deal of responsibility on us in a way that perhaps we don't want, you know. And so in the simplest way, you know, this is kind of expressed in the beginning of the Dhammapada, which the first translation I ever read said something like, the mind is the forerunner of all things, meaning that before anything happens, before we do anything, there's a thought. And that thought might just be an impulse or an intention. It might not be verbalized, might not appear in the mind as a verbal thought, but there's an impulse. There is the mental desire to do something. And, you know, the example I like of this is when you look at a building, you realize, oh, that building was the thought, was a thought in an architect's mind at one time before it became a building. So thoughts come before actions. And so this is one of the big reasons why we practice mindfulness of thoughts, right? Because if you don't see what you're thinking, you don't understand how you got where you got. Like, what am I doing here? You know, you have those moments when you like arrive somewhere, you've been driving, like you get home from work and you're like, I don't even remember driving. Like I was in my head the whole way, right? Well, I mean, that's okay if you're going home and you find your way. But, you know, who among us hasn't like found ourselves in some situation where like, how did I get here? What did I do to make, you know, I don't want to be here, because we weren't paying attention to our thoughts. We weren't careful and seeing that, all of that, and what was manifesting from that. That this is why thoughts are so important. They really do initiate everything that happens in our lives. So I'll talk a little bit more about this. So the idea that there is karma from thoughts, one of the most important manifestations of karma from thoughts is not anything that happens externally, but the emotions that arise from our thoughts. How many of our feelings, of our difficult feelings, arise because of a thought we have? A thought of self-judgment is a big one, you know, a thought of fear of something that's going to happen, a thought of anger, you know, and a whole range of thoughts, right? That if we don't see them, we find ourselves caught up in an emotion or a mood. And we start to pile on with that, you know. And the, you know, again, if you're not watching, then you're in a mood, and then you start thinking about your mood, and then you're like, "What's wrong with me?" And then you're like, "Oh, I'm so messed up." And then you're getting worse, right? The thoughts pile up and create like a feedback loop, a negative feedback loop in the mind. And it's so important to be able to like stop. Breathe. Okay, I'm thinking this. This is just a thought. It's not a reality. I don't have to believe this. This is actually the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy, right? Not believing what you're thinking. Well, you can't not believe your thoughts if you don't see your thoughts. There's a really odd sentence, but you have to see them first before you can intervene. So this becomes so critical to us, just mindfulness of thinking. And it's so interesting that people, when they come to meditation, they so often think that, oh, I'm not supposed to be thinking. What's, you know, I've got to stop my thoughts because, like, you know, I'm trying to just stay with my breath, right? And it's like, yeah, that's great. But are you noticing what you're thinking? Because there's a lot of information in there that could be useful for you if you paid attention. Like, oh, right, what am I thinking? You know, we don't really want to make that our meditation. It's like, I'm sitting here, I'm trying to get peaceful, and like, it's really bothering me, all this crap in my head, like, stop, you know? It's like, yeah, okay. But maybe just notice, like, what is that crap right now? Oh, yeah. Interesting. Okay, that's what I'm caught in. Okay. And, you know, just seeing that, right, allows you to step out of it, allows you to say, okay, I don't have to follow this. Okay, there's feeling is there, that thought is there. Okay, I'm just going to let it just be there. I'm not going to carry it around with me and build, you know, buildings based on the thought. Wow, I need a drink of water. You know, I do get emotional talking about this, you know, and it, because it means so much to me, and it is so much of my own personal struggle, you know, but when I say that, the reason I share it is because I believe that it's the struggle of a lot of people. And, you know, there are those people who don't have a lot of negative thoughts or painful thoughts or difficult thoughts or anxious thoughts, who just, like, that's just not their karma. It's not their fate, whatever. That's not, you know, but that's not me. And I think I do tend to think that addicts probably don't tend to be those people so much. I know there's some happy-go-lucky addicts out there, but, you know, a lot of us have these disordered thoughts, you know. So going back to Buddhadasa, you know, we beseech the law of karma through our action, not merely with words. So we start by trying to change our thinking in some way, or intervene in our thinking, change our relationship to our thinking. It's not, I don't even really like the idea of so much, I'm going to change my thinking, like I'm just going to have positive thoughts. It's not so much about that. It's like, do I see my thoughts? Do I believe my thoughts? Am I able to let go of my thoughts? Am I able to see that they're impermanent? Am I able to see that they're not reality? that they are just thoughts. All of that to me is more important than, oh, I'm going to change them. Because as soon as I, when I can apply those kind of principles, then the thoughts just don't get their claws in me. They're like, oh yeah, there I go again. That's basically it, right? And if you go on meditation retreat, you know, you get to do that a lot. Like, oh, there I go again, you know. And you find yourself laughing. If you're really being mindful of your thoughts, after a while, you're like, who is this person? Like, who is this nut that I'm walking around with? You know, Gil Fronsdale makes that, and other meditation teachers make that point. Like, if somebody walked around and just leaned into your ear all day long and said the stuff that you say to yourself, you'd be like, get away from me, go away. But we allow it, we feed it, right? So we start by beseeching the law of karma, to have our change our relationship to our thoughts. And then, of course, yeah, we change the way we talk to people, and we change the way we act in the world. And all of that transforms our lives. I don't know what our shortcomings are. You know, I don't know what that is. What I know is, like, I have this life that involves, like, thoughts, feelings, actions, words, and that, all that stuff changes when I change it, you know, when I bring mindfulness to it, when I bring a different attitude, when I bring compassion, when I bring an attitude of loving kindness, you know, of joy. You know, I was, in some ways, a painfully shy kid. You would never know it. Here I am. And I remember, you know, I don't talk a lot about, I spent quite a bit of time in a mental hospital when I was 18. And I remember, like, there, I was in the open part of the hospital for a long time where you could come and go, which was pretty cool because, anyway, it wasn't like being, it was more like staying in an old hotel. In any case, I remember walking down the hall and people coming toward me, and I could not look them in the eye. I could not say hello. I had to look down, and persistently, like, I would never say hello to anybody I would pass in the hall. I would just walk by them. And you know, this could be a nurse or a doctor, not necessarily another mental patient. And as I say, this is like the open part where the sort of semi-normal types were. But, you know, when I think about that self, that kid, you know, who was like so shy that, you know, couldn't smile and like be friendly, you know. I mean, there's karma that's being created with that, right? Which is like distancing and non-connection. And, you know, when you walk, now when I walk down the street, or when I, you know, and many, as I'm sure most of you, like, you pass someone in your neighborhood or somewhere, you know, that feels socially comfortable, you smile and you say hi, you know, and that feels good, right? And that's, you know, that's an action. That's beseeching the law of karma, and it's creating a positive effect. It's creating a, it feels good internally, and the other person smiles and feels good, and there's this moment of connection, and it's lovely, right? But it's just like these ways that we can cripple ourselves. I mean, I was like emotionally crippled in this way that I couldn't do that. You know, that the only way I could do that is like have a few drinks, you know, and then I could be like, hey, what's happening? You know, you want to sleep with me kind of thing. You know, that's about how, you know. Yeah, you guys are very kind. Thank you for your smiles. So this is how we change our karma, through our thoughts, words, and deeds. It's not magic, right? You know, I was talking to someone today who's trying to get sober and trying to take her through a process, what she needed to do. And it was this, you know, just, you know, there's no magic to it. takes a very powerful intention, and I am really grateful that all of you, and so many of you who've been hanging out with me for a while, have done a lot of work to be here and to be safe, that you're safely clean and sober and able to, you know, deepen and enrich your life through practice, not be, you know, falling into relapse and all the pain and struggle that people go through in early recovery. So blessings to all of you and all of us. And a few minutes left for anybody who wants to chime in. Hey, Charlie. Hi.
Hi, Kevin. What about the defilements? I always kind of thought that the character defects were kind of really defilements. I hate the word character defect because, like you were saying, I don't feel like I'm defective. How would you class the defilements?
I don't love that word either, you know, but yeah. So like greed, hatred, and delusion, are we talking about that?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, how do I think of them, like in relation to this language of the character defects? And
yeah.
I mean, the Buddha is so brilliant, right? Because he kind of captures it all, like anybody's inventory is just captured in those three ideas, greed, hatred, and delusion, and there are many, many different manifestations. So yeah, like the hindrances, you know, they're not really personal, right? They're these human tendencies. They're the tendencies of the unawakened human. And just like with all of the rest of the things I've been talking about, the only way to let go of them is to be mindful. But that mindfulness isn't enough, because there needs to be an intention. So first of all, so we have to start with the right view, right? That actually sees, oh, greed, hatred, and delusion are destructive energies that only lead to suffering for me and for others. And that insight, that right view, then should motivate me, hopefully motivates me, to set an intention to not let them be the driving forces in my life. Because we know that many, many people, you know, use those energies as their motivation, right? I want to accumulate as much money as I can. I want to take as much power as I can. And they're lost in that delusion. So we need the right view, and we need then intention, and then we need to apply mindfulness to that work. Which is, yeah, I mean, it's just another way in, to me, to this process. It's all about, we're human beings. What do we got? You know, what's going on inside of us, and how can we engage it? I don't know. Does that make sense? Is there something? Can you add more? I'd be happy to hear.
No, no, that makes sense. And I like the way that, I mean, but you know, when I think about the defilements, I think, take jealousy, you know, jealousy. Yeah. But then you can narrow it down to the hindrances, and it's, you know, it comes under the heading of ill will. So, you know, I guess what I think of is, you know, when talks about somebody that is enlightened, they don't have any defilements. Mm.
Well, we'll have to They won't tell you that they're enlightened, so I guess you just have to watch them to see if that's the case. I mean, it's a good question, because there's also sometimes that suggestion in the suttas that thinks when we see Mara showing up in the suttas trying to get the Buddha to act unskillfully, and then the Buddha always says, "Oh, I see you, Mara," and Mara's like, "Oh, you caught me," and Mara leaves. And most of the teachers I've heard talk about that suggest that maybe Mara's this expression of the Buddha's own mind, that maybe these thoughts appear for him, but they don't take any hold within him. So does that mean he doesn't have defilements, or they just don't have any power or any influence on them? It's one of those perennial questions. We'd have to ask Anālio what he thinks, probably, if we want to, or Bhikkhu Bodhi.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to see you on Friday nights. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions here? It's All-Star weekend, so there's no game for me to watch afterwards. So I'm not in a hurry, I know. Hey, Debbie. Hey.
Hi. I've missed a couple sessions recently, so it feels good to be back with family here. Part of this whole perspective, when I'm thinking of the character of defects, that phrase versus, say, defilements or the 10 fetters, for me, what I really felt into as a difference is one feels very judgmental, character defects. The other one just feels like this is a natural part of being human for us to be aware of. And so there's a little bit of freeing in that, where I don't have to be punishing myself. It's just as, oh, this is part of what we're going to experience, and can we watch out and be aware? And then, just as we're talking here, I'm thinking, Buddha and saying, Mara, I see you. For me, it's like that was Buddha's label. Like when I'm making a big plan for what I have to do for the party next week or whatever, I'll just go back to planning, right? So I kind of look at that. That was a way of distancing, labeling it one more, way of being able to be the witness rather than be closer to being attached or caught up in something that may not serve well-being.
No, I think that's exactly right. I just want to clarify for anybody who might not get what you mean by the Buddha's label. You meant that that's his way of naming the thing that he was experiencing. It's not like his brand or something like.
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
And this is just a little thing that I'm going, oh, well, this is kind of cool. That was how he labeled, I don't know.
No.
And it's just something I can kind of relate to in my own practice, seeing it kind of as a spacer of
Yeah.
awareness and it not being having so much power over me.
Yeah. No, I think the impersonal part is so critical. And it's one of the reasons why, in the rain practice, the suggestion, so people who aren't familiar with rain, it's an acronym for recognize, accept, investigate, and then originally non-identify, but some teachers have changed it to nurture. And I'm always like, yeah, but you don't want to lose non-identify, because just as you were just saying, not identifying is almost the critical piece of all our letting go, of a lot of our letting go. It's just really important, because when you see, oh, I there's this is arising for me, I'm having this feeling, I'm having this thought, it's still easier to think, oh, it's mine. What's wrong with me that I'm having it? Like, you know, just by being mindful, it's not necessarily going to let go of it. So it's really important that we have that additional piece and that we nurture ourselves. So I guess I want rain and, you know, nurture and non-identify. Rain and anyway, sorry. We're having fun here, Friday night, woohoo! But no, I think you really landed on it right too. The problem, and this is, you know, sort of brings us back to like the kind of distinction between like a 12-step approach or thinking about recovery and a Buddhist approach to recovery. One of the critical pieces is that Buddhism definitely kind of, you know, puts its stamp on the idea that this is not I. And in the 12-step world, I believe that that's really where it wants to go, but it's very easy because it is so story oriented to get caught in story, in self, and in I. You know, as I like to point out, the 12th tradition says that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. You know, anonymity, which is not having a name, not having a self, letting go of self. You know, so there is this implication, I believe, in the steps that we're trying to get past self. And, you know, when our spiritual awakening, having had a spiritual awakening, we tried to carry this message, immediately getting out of self. So we know that that's there, and people will tell you that, and you'll hear that. But the fact that at most meetings you go to, the main thing that happens at the meeting is that somebody gets up and tells their story, then people share about their stories, can kind of, you know, get you entangled a little bit, I think, and maybe isn't the most direct way to letting go of self, that we have that nice instruction in Buddhism. And I'll say, you know, I think people often get confused with the idea of, oh, there's not a self. But when we say, yeah, but don't, instead of thinking about it in these grand terms, oh, there is no self, just think about, like, is that thought you? Do you have to believe, you know, do you have to take that personally? You know, are you identifying with that? And then all of a sudden, the idea of not self becomes much more useful and meaningful and practical. It's not like a philosophical question or metaphysical question of who is I and all that. It's like, I'm not actually that interested in that question. But when I see how thinking about myself as a self, you know, and identifying with things causes suffering, then I'm interested in letting go of self, right? And then it's very practical and useful, like step away. Oh, okay. Yeah, these are just the hindrances. These are just the defilement. These are just the fetters. You know, these are just things that arise for people. So thank you all for showing up on a Friday night. And I'll be back around on Tuesday morning in my traditional time. It truly is just, you know, I don't get to talk to individuals here that much, but I see your names and your faces, and I really enjoy having all of you here, and, you know, especially all of you who show up, have been really showing up a lot for these years. It means a lot to me, and I really, it enriches my life tremendously to be able to show up and hang out with you guys. So thank you. So as a, you know, as a practice to take out of today, let's work with non-self, what that means, not identifying with the things that arise in the coming days. All right.
Besides, where else can you go on a Friday night to get a free comedy show?
There you go.
Yeah.
Kevin, what did the A in rain stand for?
Well, I say acceptance. Some people say allow. but it's like recognize what's happening. Yep. Then you kind of allow it, just like accept it. Okay, that's what I'm not getting bothered. Then you investigate to see very clearly, how does this arise? How does this pass? And then you disidentify and nurture yourself in the process.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Tara Brach writes a lot about it. She has a book that's, I think, called like The Radical Practice of Rain or something like that. So you can find it there.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Good night.
Good night. Good night, everybody. Peace. Thank you, happy President's Day. I hope all the presidents are happy.
See you Tuesday.